Hey, everybody. Welcome to In the Know with Nina. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Crowley. I'm the Director of Clinical Education and Partnerships at CECA, where we partner with healthcare providers and clinicians to offer body composition solutions. Today, I am so excited to be joined by a fellow PhD dietitian, Dr. Michelle Cardell. She is the Chief Nutrition Officer at Weight Watchers, and she's all over the space that we are here talking about today. And she's actually been part of a group that's developed a new tool, the food noise questionnaire. And I wanted to talk all about that today and hear more about it. So thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Nina. It's great to see you.
Yeah. So I know you've done a ton of really cool things in this space. So I appreciate your voice, in the food noise space. Tell me a little bit maybe about the research, about what led you guys to develop this questionnaire, because it seems, on my very quick initial review, it seems simple enough, but specific enough to help and like really tied to clinical outcomes and behavior change. And so that's all the stuff that I'm super into.
Yeah, absolutely. So first, like to level set for folks listening, food noise is defined as like a constant intrusive thoughts about food that are disruptive to daily life. They're not driven by hunger, but they can occur even when somebody has recently eaten or even while they're still eating. It can happen to anyone, and it can be triggered by a number of factors such as environment, mood, health conditions, or even genetics. And the reason why we wanted to develop a food noise questionnaire is because, with the advances with GLP-1 medications, we were hearing all the time from patients, oh my gosh, like now that I'm on these medications for the first time in my life, my food noise, this like constant chatter around food in my brain has been quieted. You're hearing this anecdotally from patients and pretty consistent across different patient populations. And we wanted a way to measure it, as scientists, which I very much know you appreciate, we wanted a standardized way to assess this. And so we worked with Dr. Corby Martin and Dr. H.M. Dictes at Pennington Biomedical Research Center. And in collaboration with the Weight Watchers science team, we developed this food noise questionnaire and tested it in 400 individuals.
That's awesome. I actually know one of the first sort of written pieces came from Weight Watchers that was like a study of folks and how many people were experiencing this. I don't know why 57% was sticking in my head, but there was really finally some data on, oh, this is something other than just what people say. But then it, to me, also highlighted that people who don't have it don't get it,
totally.
Right? And it's like that sort of, my analogy is always when I'm sitting on my back porch and you all of a sudden hear that, I don't know if it's the heater or the AC unit, whatever that annoying background noise is, shut off. All of a sudden you're like, oh, so peaceful and beautiful out here. But you didn't really know it was on. It wasn't, something that you could name. I can't even name it now, what's happening. But when it's gone, it's gone, and it's lovely. So I feel like that is how I've heard folks describe food noise. But people who don't get it are like, what do you mean? Why can't you just eat less like me and be a small weight,
No, I love that analogy so much because it really encompasses what we hear from patients. And I mean, patients have said things to me like, is this what lean people feel like all the time? Like, what do you mean you weren't like constantly thinking about food all the time? And it's, to me, it's such an indication that obesity is a chronic disease because it's your biology. Your biology is what is driving that food noise. And I always think about it as like almost like a King Kong versus Bambi phenomena, when like your biology is working, against you in every way, between the food noise, the physiological drive to, eat and consume excess calories. And then, for so long, the only tools were behavioral weight management and bariatric surgery. And yes, we had pharmacotherapy options, but from an efficacy perspective, it was like 10% body weight loss or less generally. And so there was this gap between that 10% body weight loss and like the 25 to 35% we were seeing with bariatric surgery. And understandably, so many patients had hesitation around bariatric surgery. So it's really exciting to see that the advances with GLP-1 medications have filled that. And that, as a result, people are experiencing less food noise.
Yeah. And I think one of the things as a dietitian I love about it is that, of course, there's a lot of bias that we need to talk about when people are saying, oh, you know, it's the easy way out, or all the stuff that, you know, people who don't maybe need these medications are taking it for cosmetic and all. Anyway, all of that aside, what I love the most is how people who I know have worked really hard from these nutrition behavior perspectives for years and not seen any, you know, maybe significant success long term, but they have that muscle memory for that nutrition. So for the most part, I would say we're not going in and saying, you know, here's new information. Like, hey, did you know this is how to, you know, eat healthily? No, these people could teach the class. This is how my bariatric patients always were. They could get up and teach the class on what you're supposed to eat and what you should eat. It's just they struggle to do that consistently long term. But I just love that they're able to kind of harness that. You know, you're removing something that makes it much easier for them to do the things they intentionally always wanted to do. So for dietitians, I feel like, well, then that's the fun part. You take the biology as the barrier, and now they want to get creative and try new stuff and, you know, do more cooking and do more meal planning. It's kind of a beautiful place to be, especially as a dietitian.
I could not agree more. It's, you know, with that food noise being taken out of the picture, for the first time, patients are able to adhere to the lifestyle modifications that they have been engaged in for most of them decades. And the medications really help facilitate that healthier lifestyle. And we just completed a 6-month clinical trial with Dr. Leslie Heinberg at Cleveland Clinic. Okay. And we measured changes in diet quality in patients that were either taking semaglutide or tirzepatide and were on the Weight Watchers GLP-1 companion program. So basically, it's a behavioral weight management program that's specifically tailored for folks on GLP-1 medications. And we saw huge improvements in diet quality over the 6 months. We measured it using Healthy Eating Index, and we consider it to be clinically significant if you improve your Healthy Eating Index score by 3 points. And in this 6-month trial, we saw a 10-point increase in Healthy Index scores. So it's very different than what we see in bariatric surgery patients, where patients tend to eat smaller portion sizes, but their overall diet quality doesn't tend to improve. Whereas at least when they're combining it with a behavioral program that's specifically targeting these nutritional targets, they are improving their overall dietary pattern. So really exciting to see.
Also, that's exciting too, because I feel like in the media, we hear a lot about, you know, sort of again, that bias of, oh, people are just taking the medication and then eating whatever they want, right? Like, I have so many air quotes. I just keep these up. They say that so much. And it's like, I love that there's actual research supporting, like, no, we're allowing them to do the intentional things that they've always wanted to do. And to me, that's a huge impact on the bias people have towards what they think people are able to or wanting to do from a food and nutrition perspective.
Absolutely. I mean, what we see with patients is they're so eager to implement, you know, all these lifestyle modifications. They're eager to engage in more resistance training, changing, you know, their diet. But I will give the caveat that this data was, you know, for patients getting comprehensive care, like wraparound care with a clinician. They had access to registered dietitians, fitness consultants, and then a behavioral program that guided them towards these overall healthier dietary patterns and ensuring nutritional adequacy in terms of calories and protein and fiber and hydration. What does concern me is a lot of patients who are getting these prescriptions from either these startups that are just giving the prescription or from their primary care provider, where the primary care provider just doesn't have the time or the resources to take them through how should their diet change on these medications? What should their physical activity levels look like, et cetera? So I think, you know, in cases where people are getting comprehensive care, absolutely, it's a huge win. But I do worry about patients who aren't getting the support that they likely need.
Yeah, I mean, the piece on comprehensive care, and I don't even know if that word means something to people outside of our little world, but you know, all the components, right? The nutrition, the exercise, the behavior, and even support with the prescription. I mean, getting a prescription is kind of just the beginning of a long-term struggle or relationship with your pharmacy of they have the supply. That whole piece of it's huge. And so that, for me, that was actually a big burnout in the bariatric surgery world, which was the prior auths and the getting insurance approval for something that so clearly demonstrated benefit to the patient. So I do hope that we get better at that for medication, but I know that can be a struggle as well. But yeah, so tell me, I could talk about this with you probably all day. So I do want to hear about the questionnaire, if you can kind of give me an overview of it and where it might be available, how can people use it? And then I think we can really figure out how to start promoting that as a tool to modify or to measure changes that people are experiencing.
Yes. So we published the food noise questionnaire in the journal Obesity back in January of 2025. It is free to use. Anybody can use it. We do put in there that people please reach out to Dr. Corby Martin, who was the corresponding author on the manuscript, and then myself, just to, you know, check in with us, make sure everything's okay. But we've had several people reach out to us that are already using it. Some pharmaceutical companies are using it. Some, you know, hospitals are using it with their patients. And it's very simple. It's only a 5-question questionnaire.
Oh, 5. I was thinking 7.
Super short. Well, we tested 7 questions and then we narrowed it down to the 5 that were most relevant for the construct. So it's super easy to use. It's free. Highly encourage people to use it. And I do think it's something that we're seeing is being utilized, at least at the Weight Watchers Clinic, in helping to, inform clinical protocols and treatment, because the clinicians tell us it's, you know, it's one thing for us to assess side effect symptoms and severity, which is clearly very important in determining titration protocols for the medication. But, you know, I think we could really use this to personalize treatment even farther. So there's just a lot of potential there using the food noise questionnaire.
I love that. And, you know, I think, I don't know when I heard this, but Dr. Robin Pashby, who's a behavioral, you know, psychologist, love her. Health psychologist. She talked about this in a talk one time about how even for patients who are not seeing the weight changes or the body composition changes that we're expecting with medication, it may be a reason to keep someone on medication if the reduction in food noise is such that it's giving them, you know, peace in their life in these other ways. And I thought that was a really interesting concept. That was, of course, before this came out. And so now I can imagine, just like we would say, you know, hey, your quality of life is better, or hey, your medications that you're on or your other health conditions have been reduced. This would be another way to say, hey, we took you from a, I don't know what the scoring is, but a 100 down to a 50, and that has allowed you to improve your diet quality, even if you're not seeing change in some of those biochemical markers that we're looking for.
Yeah, it's so true. And first off, I absolutely love Robin. She's amazing. But I think she's spot on this. And we've had patients say to us, even if I never lost another pound, I would want to stay on the medication because of the freedom it's given me away from the food noise. We're also seeing in our clinical trials reductions in disordered eating behaviors, yeah, reductions in emotional eating. Anecdotally, patients are sharing that, like, we have one patient who, and she's talked openly about this, that she used to have weekly, usually at least bi-weekly binge eating episodes. And since she started on a GLP-1 medication, she has not had a single binge eating episode. And she said for her, so far above and beyond the weight piece, it's that change in her brain and not having those binge eating episodes has added so much from a quality of life perspective. So yeah, it's really powerful what these medications can do.
And that, you know, even just hearing that reminds me again of why it is important that we're not talking about them as weight loss medications,
right?
You know? And so I'm always the language, you know, police and the stickler for, like, what are the right words? And I don't even know, because part of me doesn't like how we're calling everything GLP-1. Mm-hmm. Somehow that term has stuck with the public. But part of me likes it because it's classifying the medication, mm-hmm, but not necessarily its target. And you can't keep up with all the targets that are improving, whether that's, you know, liver or sleep or heart health, all of these areas, brain health, right? And all the behavioral stuff. So if we're talking about the class of medication and not just what it's treating, I do feel like that helps us move away from it just being a weight loss or weight management medication.
I love that perspective. And like you're saying, like, it seems like every week there's new publications coming out on other benefits. You know, our science team actually published in JAMA Network Open in November about changes in alcohol consumption in our study population. So in over 14,000 patients, wow, we had over 7,000 who drank any alcohol at baseline, and about half of them reduced their alcohol consumption. And those who were heavy drinkers at baseline were 19 times more likely to reduce their alcohol consumption relative to light drinkers at baseline, and moderate drinkers at baseline were about 6 times more likely. So particularly for those who are drinking more, they're seeing huge shifts away from those cravings and just ultimately choosing not to drink anymore. Plus the unwanted side effects from drinking on these medications. You know, I've had patients say that I used to be able to have, you know, 2 or 3 margaritas and I'd be okay. And if I do that now, I'll like throw up for hours. So there's definitely a negative feedback loop there as well.
I think that's so, so important that we continue to sort of push thinking about that. And it does make it hard when you see people who maybe are, there's a lot of talk about inappropriate usage of medications and all of that too. And so I just think we're still babies in the understanding of all the ways these are going to be used as a class of medications. And I really do like the push away from just calling it weight. But I mean, you working where you work, I know you guys probably have those conversations all the time about, you know, what is it, weight health? Is it obesity management medications? Like, I don't know the right term for it. Maybe it is calling it by the class. I giggled when we first heard the nutrient stimulated, I can't even recall it, nutrient stimulated hormone therapy. Is that it?
I think so. I think Dr. Jostabroff is who came up with that one.
Like, I love it for being precise at describing what they do, but I'm like, figuring out what hits in the public. I mean, that's a whole nother thing.
Absolutely. And everybody calling, you know, it Ozempic. And it's right. Like, look, you know, it's, I love your idea of like just focusing on the class of medications rather than calling it, you know, a weight management medication or a diabetes medication, because like you're saying, it's so much more than that now. It's a sleep apnea medication. It's a, you know, kidney medication, a liver medication.
Yeah.
So many indications that are coming out now. And I think that's going to continue. They're doing research on Alzheimer's and substance use disorders. So there's a lot of promise in this space, but I very much think we're in the infancy of our understanding of what these medications can do and, you know, how we can best utilize them across various patient populations.
Okay, so I need to get into the 5 questions, but can you give me a question or two just so we know, like, what's the type of question? And then do we scale? Is it like a Likert 5-point scale? How do we someone rank on the questionnaire? And then how might we use it? Do we just assess response to medication, or is there other ways, you know, that we can use the results from the questionnaire?
So in terms of how you can use the questionnaire, so it goes from 0 to 20, and we looked in, you know, about 400 participants to look at like what was the best fit. And we found that, you know, it was ultimately psychometrically valid, which just means, you know, it's actually testing what we think it's testing. Remind me of your other question. I felt like there was like, just like
so the scale. So actually then a high score would be 100 or 0?
0 to 20.
On each question.
No, the total. Okay. So basically each question can do, it's a 5-point Likert scale. So sorry, I said 20. It's out of 25.
25. Got it.
Simple math. Okay.
So a high score, what would we call a high score on that then out of the 25?
So we did see differences by age and race. What we're doing now is when we're giving people feedback on it, we base it on like a percentage. We give them feedback like your score was like 98th percentile. So you scored higher than 98% of, you know, the population. We haven't created clinical cutoffs. That's something that is kind of in next steps, but very much want to get to a point where we can say to people, you know, this would be a low, this would be a moderate, this would be a high, but we're just not there yet with the science.
Yeah. I mean, in body comp, we are very aware of that, you know, wanting people really sort of want that number and that cutoff. And like, if I'm higher than this, is that good or bad? And so I do like even knowing that in different populations, the normal ranges will be a little bit different, you know, because I'd imagine norming this is not, it may take a little bit.
Yeah. And the type of questions that we ask are like, I find myself constantly thinking about food throughout the day. My thoughts about food feel uncontrollable. I spend too much time thinking about food. My thoughts about food have negative effects on me and or my life, and that my thoughts about food distract me from what I need to do. If anybody wants to take the quiz, you can Google like Weight Watchers food noise questionnaire, and okay. we do have it available. So if people want to see where they fall on the range, they're welcome to do that. It's
okay.
cost.
Great. Yeah, we'll put that in the notes for sure. I just think it's a nice, even, you know, I've been talking a lot to other dietitians about what they're doing in this space and how they're, you know, what kind of questions they're asking and what kind of counseling they're doing. So I feel like whether it's, you know, just being aware of this as a concept or doing that more formally, I think that could be a good piece to include in the assessment and the follow-up.
Absolutely. I totally agree.
So yeah, so what's next? It sounds like testing it in larger groups of people.
Testing it in large groups. We want to see changes. We have done some preliminary findings looking at folks on GLP-1 medications as well as folks on a behavioral weight management program. Mm-hmm. I actually thought that we wouldn't see changes in folks on a behavioral weight management program. And if we did, we might actually see increases in food noise. But actually, we saw significant reductions in both the GLP-1 group and the Weight Watchers behavioral weight management. My guess there is that on the GLP-1 side, it's biologically driven. And then on the behavioral side, it's driven by behaviorally nudging folks towards foods that are more satiating, more fiber, eating foods that help them feel fuller for longer. That's what I'm guessing. But the effect was more modest in the behavioral weight management group than it was in the GLP-1 group.
How would you describe, because even as hearing you say that, I'm thinking the way people's words describe food cravings versus food noise can be kind of gray area. Do you have a good way of explaining the difference?
So food cravings is something, you know, all of us experience. You know, if you walk by one of those like delicious ice cream shops and, you know, like the smell just comes like out of the windows and doors seemingly, like it's a normal physiological response to then crave something in response to that external stimuli. Food noise is quite different in that it's ever present and it can happen even in the absence of some sort of trigger.
Okay. That's a good way to put it. Yeah. And like you said earlier, people who don't have it can't describe it really. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. You get hungry, you eat, and you move on from that. And it's quite opposite for folks who have high levels of that.
Well, I saw, you know, I've seen some people post about it and get some pretty tough feedback online, you know, because they've taken this like very strong stance that food noise isn't real and it's just hunger. And it's kind of one of those things of, tell me you've never experienced food noise without telling me you've never experienced food noise. You know, when you take that adamant stance, I believe, as I know you do too, really strongly in listening to patients, learning from patients, believing what your patients tell you. And this phenomena is very real. And we do see differences by weight status in terms of the level of food noise that people experience.
Yeah, I have had that experience where people feel finally heard, liberated by, you know, oh, that, like, I'm not the only one, you know, and that's a very rewarding, you know, from a clinician standpoint, hearing that and hearing them, someone move through that and be able to move on, you know, okay, well, I thought I was crazy out here by myself. And so I love that. So yeah, I think this is the beginning of some really good change in our clinical practice too, because this is something that we probably all need to be talking to patients about and then looking at, you know, outcomes related to that. And I'd be interested to see if there's any weight related or body composition related outcomes that are different. You know, does reducing this much, or is it just the etiology of the medication that does the trick? So
yeah, absolutely. I think that would be really exciting. I think there's growing interest in how the food noise questionnaire could be used in future research. You know, and another piece of this is I think that understanding food noise really provides this powerful kind of counter narrative to that harmful notion that people with overweight or obesity just, quote unquote, lack willpower. And by naming and measuring this experience, we really can validate the struggles many face and give clinicians this like new lens for care, like you were alluding to. And this is part of the approach to reducing stigma and improving standards of care and helping providers really recognize obesity as a chronic condition.
Well, that in a nutshell is a perfect closing. I think that's fantastic. Thank you so much for all of your insight on this and for your work. And I'll make sure that we link to the questionnaire, to a quiz of how to take it. Best place to follow you.
You can follow me on Instagram and TikTok at Dr. Michelle Cardell. And I am on Twitter and LinkedIn as well.
Well, I'll see you in Chicago very soon. And I appreciate your time. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Nina. You take care.